Okay, welcome everyone to our Zion conference call Sunday evenings. Tonight we're going to visit with Andrea from Idaho about Babylon. Elder Christofferson said that Babylon is the antithesis and antagonist of Zion. So we're going to explore that tonight. So, Andrea, what does it mean to be the antithesis of Zion?
Well, you know, often people think antithesis means literally the opposite. But I like to use the definition that's also used for an antihero. And if you actually look at what Babylon was, you'll see that this meaning is really quite spot on. And that is, there's actually two types of antiheroes. There's the type that is literally the opposite, but there's the other type that is the same in every way except in like one or two ways that matter the most. So James Bond is a really good example of an antihero. He's the hero in all of his movies, and he's awesome, but he lacks certain principles. He lacks certain, he lacks purity, I guess you could say. And Babylon also fits that really well. So if you look into history, and instead of looking at the Bible's
version,
version of Babylon, which is still a very important version, so not ignoring it, but just going to history's version, Babylon was a great city. It was the city of light. It was the city of gold. It was the city of innovation. It was really looked on with great awe and wonder during its time. And that's an important thing to realize and recognize. Because if we truly want to get away from Babylon, we have to be able to look at what they did right and where that vital myth was that made Babylon the antithesis of Zion.
Sounds fun. Let's do it.
So, why don't you tell me what to you Babylon means, and what to you Zion means? Well, just a quick summation, I guess.
A quick summation. There's a quote by Jedediah M. Grant from 1854. I'll just read it here. "The world is more or less controlled all the time by influences that Lucifer evidently is not opposed to. He has little objection to the present organization of human society from the fact that everything passes along in the wake that agrees with his religion and rather tends towards his purposes." To me, that present organization of human society, where the focus is on materialism, is on hedonism, is on basically the pursuit of power, gain, and glory, which the Book of Mormon warns against. It's a society based on principles of pride, and Zion is a society based on principles of humility, and pride being two-part. I don't need no stinking God telling me what to do, and part B, so that's pride between me and God, and then part two is pride between me and my neighbor. In other words, where I think I'm better than or less than my neighbor. And the foundational elements of Babylon or Babylon, to me, is a society based on those principles. We don't need God. We can do it ourselves. And some people are better than others, more deserving.
Absolutely.
And so Zion would be the opposite of that, based on the idea that there is a God, he loves us, we need his wisdom, and if we were to work with him instead of against him, things will go better. And then humility in relation to our neighbor, you know, twice in DNC, whatever it is, the Lord says, esteem your brother as yourself. Verily I say unto you, esteem your brother as yourself. When the Lord repeats something twice in the scriptures, it's pretty important. So to me, that's what Zion is. It's a society based on where the social institutions, the schools, the governments, the businesses, the social organizations, the churches, are all based on principles of humility, where Zion, where Babylon is the opposite. That's my working definition.
Wonderful. So Babylon, when it was founded, it was actually a great empire twice. It was really built up twice. And when it was first created, and really the same principles the second time. So either time you can really kind of use the same explanation. What happened was they basically, a ruler had this, and I'm not thinking of his name right at the moment.
Nimrod.
Although
was
the second time,
wasn't Nimrod the first leader of Babylon?
By the Bible's account, yes. It's disputed in history, but there's a different name, which could still be Nimrod.
I've heard Nimrod went by like a dozen names.
Yeah, which is very, very, very possible, especially back then. But when it was created, it was this whole idea of, I want to create the best, most... the best society with the most intelligence, the most culture, the most of the best of everything that this world has to offer. And at this point, conquering other tribes and people and kingdoms and stuff was already kind of the norm. The way that they decided to go about it was exactly that. Well, I can't get them to come and cooperate with me if I just ask. So I'll just conquer them, and then I'll force them to cooperate with me. So not that it had the very worst of intentions, because you have to remember that that was kind of the culture and the understanding that they had at the time. So I don't exactly want to completely damn them or villainize them based on that, but that was really what was going on. They would just go in and conquer a people and say, okay, now give me your best and your brightest, and they're going to come to Babylon, to the capital city, and they are going to live with me either here in my palace or somewhere where I have complete control and can keep an eye over them. And then I'm going to treat them like guests and treat them well, but of course they also can't leave. So they're right. Still slaves in that and imprisoned in that sense. But they really did make a point of treating them the best that they knew how to make sure. I mean, you read about Daniel and right. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they wanted to make sure that they had the best diet. And it was Daniel who and his friends, you know, saying, no, we won't eat this way because this goes against what we believe. And if we can prove that our diet is better for us, you know, will you let us do it? And they did. Because they really did want the best. And so there really is a lot to be learned from and gained from Babylon. The crux being exactly what you said. One is in humility, knowing and understanding that there is no one that is better than anyone else. I may be quicker at something than someone else, but they're going to be quicker or better than me at something else. So one way or the other, we're really all...
Yeah.
So with that, you know, what are some of the gifts that we, or lessons that we have to learn from Babylon?
Well, they were widely known for their gardens, so I assume they had...
Yeah, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon.
Yeah, irrigation, and which we here in the West have already benefited from.
Absolutely. And really, that is because they really collaborated together in ways that sometimes we do and sometimes we don't.
Well, yeah, the pursuit of useful knowledge is obviously a value that's hung over, carried over to us today.
Absolutely.
That's been a value off and on ever since then. I suspect that Babylon, the story I tell myself about Babylon,
mm-hmm.
is that it was Nimrod's effort to create a city of Enoch. He was very close to that time period. He would have heard all the stories about the city of Enoch from childhood on. There is a apocryphal story about Nimrod when he realized that he could gain power by aiming his arrows at humans rather than animals, that's when he started his empire building. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if what you said is accurate, that he's trying to build, you know, an ideal city, but he missed the main point. He missed the main difference between a Zion society and Babylon, thinking that he could do it. In fact, the apocryphal story is that he escorted Noah and his wife away.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in charge now, and you guys go over here. See you later. Thanks.
Yeah, don't need you.
Yeah, I can take it from here. So, yeah, that's an interesting idea. It wouldn't surprise me at all if he was trying to build a city of Enoch, but based on false principles. And,
exactly. Well, and for me, I think that, you know, when I look at the world today and what's going on, we really have examples of both Babylon and Zion all over the place.
Yeah, we do.
In every single society. In every religion, on every continent, excuse me, it's everywhere. You have people who are doing really amazing things, and sometimes they really catch that spirit of Zion of, if we really work together and we truly hold each other in humility, look at what we can do.
Yeah.
And then you have others who are working under similar principles, excuse me, but are functioning under the principle of, I know better, and if you just follow me and do what I say, then everything will be great. In fact, that's actually what ISIS is about.
Yeah.
ISIS is not just full anti-American, want to kill all Americans. The main crux of it is that they believe that Islam is correct. Islam is the best. It teaches the best principles, and that everyone will be happier, and the world will have peace if we all live under those principles.
Yeah, if they would just do what we say.
Yeah.
Well, yeah,
our government
is functioning
under that principle.
Yeah, no kidding. I understand there. I don't know if ISIS is of this particular group, but there's an Islamic group that believes that the Messiah is actually Muslim and that he's going to come and cleanse the world of all its infidels and then, you know, bring in a millennial reign, which in many ways parallels our belief of what Christ's role is when he returns.
Absolutely.
So it seems, though, the principle, it's easy for us to see, I think, that the Islamic way of killing people who refuse to join is probably not based in humility.
No. But at the same time, you have to remember that their religion, within it, they are taught, even though in general they do not literally, they don't take this literally, but in this case, the ISIS and Islamicists are taking it, or some of them are taking it literally, that it is better for a soul to die, for someone to die, than for them to continue in this lost state, basically. I had a friend when I was living in BYU housing back over in Provo, and he was Muslim, and he had had all the discussions, and he loved the Mormon religion, the LDS Church, the Book of Mormon, all of it, loved it. But he said, you have to understand, if I converted, if I officially converted and was baptized, I would never be able to go home to my family. Because even though my family loves me and cares about me and all of those things, my life would be in danger.
Yeah.
It only takes one person for them to decide to take that literally, and he knew that there were enough of them that his life was literally in danger if he converted.
Well, I've studied quite a bit, gathered an enormous amount of quotes from the Utah territorial years about Zion.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
as I was doing that, with the intent of figuring out, okay, what did it mean to them, I ran across quotes about Babylon as well and kept them on a separate spreadsheet. And
oh,
it's
wonderful.
Interesting. Yeah, it's interesting that Brigham Young and George A. Smith and Lorenzo Snow and others saw basically they called the United States Babylon,
mm-hmm.
and that the cultural and economic traditions of that the Americans had were bleeding over into their attempt to create Zion in Utah. In fact, that was a major challenge they had. Quote after quote, they talk about how, you know, we came here to build Zion, and people are bringing in their Babylon traditions and wrecking it, which was an interesting perspective. We're never taught that in Sunday school.
It's very true, though.
Yeah. In fact, here's a quote. George A. Smith, 1856, incorrect traditions, though long followed, have to be surrendered, and we have to build up Zion. The plan of Zion contemplates that the earth, the gardens, the fields of Zion be beautiful and cultivated in the best manner possible. There's your Babylon gardens. Our traditions mm-hmm. have got to yield to that plan. Circumstances will bring us to that point, and eventually we shall be under the necessity of learning and adopting the plan of beautifying and cultivating every foot of the soil of Zion in the best possible manner. So that's interesting, that quote. He's talking about the incorrect traditions. And in the same breath, he's talking about the goal of creating an ideal society which apparently you're saying the Babylonians were trying to do themselves.
Absolutely. Well, and the hard part that comes with that is we all come with, I mean, of course, we're not born with incorrect traditions, but
right.
they, you know, we all learn them over time. And a lot of them we don't see.
Yeah.
We
yeah,
don't see them, you know, for what they are. Exactly. And
because we grew up in it. It's like if you grew up in a family and everybody had, you know, eight fingers on each hand, you would think that's normal and your neighbors were weird because they only had five.
Exactly. Exactly. And even Brigham Young talked about how the teaching, when Joseph Smith taught about the degrees of glory, how that really did not sit well with him at first. He wanted to immediately just go, no, that is not right. This is not. Because of his traditions, what he had grown up with, and how what he decided to do instead was to focus on his testimony and on the witness that he had received of the truth of the gospel, the core principles and that of the gospel and of the Book of Mormon, and to just let that sit, basically just kind of put it on a shelf.
It's a conference call on Zion. It's free.
I'm sorry, say that again?
Go ahead.
Oh, me?
Yeah, go ahead,
Anyway, and so over time, just letting that sit, those traditions started to become more apparent to him. It started to become more apparent to him that that was simply a tradition that he had grown up with and had become so comfortable with that it felt right and he didn't want to give that up. And we have to allow others to go through that same process, which is why it's really hard when trying to build Zion, because you're constantly going to have people coming in with these false traditions.
Yeah.
And you can't just say, well, you're wrong. Because that's also not Zion, you know?
Right.
It doesn't work that way. Instead, you have to just say, okay, well, this is how we're running things. This is what we're doing. And are you willing to be open to these things?
What false traditions do you see in the realm of government, economics, education, any of those areas jump out at you?
Oh, gosh.
As far as what we're living today? That most of us probably don't realize?
Well, I would say one that, to just kind of get started off, that several of us do realize and several of us and a lot of us also really kick against. But the church sure tried really hard to keep us from adopting is the public school system.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to in any way villainize the public school system.
Oh, I'll do that for you.
Well, what I mean is, like, in general,
it accomplishes
really
the purpose
truly
for which it was created.
Oh, it absolutely.
It does a great job at that. And that's a whole show.
yes, it is. Oh, my goodness. But for the most part, the teachers really do have the best interests of their students at heart.
They do.
And that's wonderful. And I definitely don't want to in any way minimize that.
Right.
But at the same time, we have to look at how that school system is set up. We have to look at the fact that there is very little true choice in the school system. It is very much about, I know what is best for you.
Right.
and I know how you're supposed to do it. So I'm going to give you a set of instructions, and you are to follow it out perfectly and to the T. And God does not work that way.
No, he does not.
And neither does Zion.
No. Yeah. In fact, if you look at the structure of any public school system, they're all set up exactly the same as the as the industry was in the mid 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
You have a board of directors, which is a school board, and it's a very strict and rigid top-down hierarchy. And the people
Absolutely.
At the bottom, who are the students, have no power or control over anything. And every level can fire at will, usually, the level
mm-hmm.
below them. And total control over what and how the level below them act.
And actually, the benefits are also the opposite of a Zion setup. Because the benefits are greatest to the people at top.
Yeah.
And the people on the bottom, like you said, they have the least choice. They get the most crapped on. And they have the least benefits.
So,
they receive the least from the system.
So have you been exposed to any schools that that incorporate more humility principles, more equality?
Oh, absolutely. The Montessori school system is a really amazing system. It is based on the principle that all students, naturally love to learn, naturally want to be challenged, and learn about pretty much everything, at least a little bit. And that is, if you let them control their education, if you let them lead the way of when and where and how they want to learn something, that they will learn so much more.
Yeah.
And then not only is the student learning a ton, but the teacher learns from them.
Mm-hmm.
And they build a community together.
I was in charge of building, in charge of a parent committee. We ended up launching a school based on a model called the Sudbury Valley School, which has been going
mm-hmm.
45 years or so in Massachusetts. And their school is very much, of all the types of schools I've seen, it's the one I think is the most founded on principles of humility, and the child has 100% of the responsibility for their education.
Yep.
And of course that freaks people out, because you know our culture tells us that a child's it's so funny. Children, I wrote a whole article about how child education or child development teaches us what children need to learn. A child, you know, they
mm-hmm.
talk about how each language you learn gets easier, right? So which
mm-hmm.
one's the hardest? The first one.
Absolutely.
And children learn language with no classrooms, no bells, no homework assignments, no desks, no marker boards, no recess.
Absolutely.
And what do they have to learn that? They have freedom to try and to fail. They have role
mm-hmm.
models. They have a safe environment. So if we give kids that...
And no
test. Why do we think at age 5 or 6, all of a sudden, the innate desire to learn that God programmed into them stops? Why do we think it stops and now we take over? It's okay, God. We got it from here. We don't need your help.
Yeah.
Thanks. Anyway...
Kids, please turn off that part of your brain that
right.
wants to explore
right.
and is curious, because we're going to do it for you from now on.
Right.
Oh, I know.
Because we know best, because, you know, we're adults. All right, so that's
yep.
education. I thought of one. See
mm-hmm.
if you can figure this one out. Agriculture. How do we apply
oh,
pride
gosh.
To agriculture?
Oh, this is such a rabbit hole. so many ways. The entire GMO, genetically modified industry, and I'm not going to pretend that it didn't start with hybridization, because yes, we have been hybridizing plants in one way or another for thousands of years. But it's still very different from genetically modified, where we are literally splicing in genes or DNA sequences, either from other complete other species. Often the plants are then, they then splice in gene sequences from a bacteria or something else, or they just figure out, they do a whole lot of messing around to figure out a change that they can make that will make this particular plant, grow and act differently. And that is incredibly egotistical.
And dangerous.
To think that, and dangerous to think that we know this. And while I am all for scientific experimentation, I think it's amazing and wonderful to really play with things and figure things out and see what benefits and that we can get from those things. I think that the motivations and intentions behind it, you have to be very, very careful of. And while they say that this is so that we can feed the rest of the world, I mean, they have this whole spiel about there are starving people all over the world, and it's these genetically modified crops that are resistant to different insects and other
and
issues,
poisons.
Other viruses and such, and poisons,
yeah,
and all of this. And that's what's going to save our feeding, our starving people. Well, okay. First
but the
of
reason
all,
they're starving is not an agricultural problem.
No, it is
it's
not.
A political
it is
problem.
Not that at all. Absolutely. And most of what is sent over in aid is no aid at all. It's just sent under the guise, under the lie of aid. And to be perfectly honest, it enrages me that they send over and they tell us, here we have a lot of people here in the U.S. who care so much about, I just want to help. I want to help these people. So then they cry out for the government to step in and aid these people. And so then the government says, look, here we are. We're aiding these people. Look at all this food that we're sending over. But what they're actually doing is they are flooding a country with free things that destroys their economy, that guarantees that these people will be begging for handouts and be in need forever, basically, until it's stopped. They guarantee that farmers in those countries now cannot produce food at a cost that anyone is willing to pay anymore. They guarantee that their clothes, we send over so many clothes. They're crap clothes. There are used clothes, but we send over huge amounts of clothes and sell it to them at bargain basement rates so that then the dressmakers and the tailors and all of that, the clothiers in those countries now cannot legitimately produce anything that people would actually pay for. They're not willing to pay those prices. So we have completely crippled these countries.
So how do we help them in a humility-based way? Or do we even help them?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, how about,
we want to help them.
Joyce?
How about learning from them? I mean, to me, the most humble thing, the most humble way to interact with another country is to go and learn from them. You learn what it is they're doing that is good, and you just see if you can add to that. If you can maybe give them some suggestions if they're interested. But to me, the humility part of it is to learn.
Yeah.
Let's learn from Absolutely. Them first before we presume to improve on it.
Well, let me share you my perspective of agriculture, pride-based agriculture.
Sure.
There's a method that was invented invented. Actually, probably restored would be a better word for it. There was a fellow in Australia who traveled around the world studying ecosystems, and about 35 years ago or so, and he had bought a new house, and it had a bunch of land in the front of the house, and he wanted to put in a garden. And having studied ecosystems all over the planet, he realized in a forest, there are no weeds that have to be pulled. Mm-hmm. There are no bugs that have to be sprayed. Plants grow abundantly without any help from people. So he thought, wow, what if I did that in my front yard? What if he discovered that by figuring it out, there are seven levels on which plants grow, everything from roots to huge canopy trees. And so he thought, well, why don't I build a garden based on a forest? So I'll have root crops and bushes and smaller trees and bigger trees and great big canopy trees and vines and all that. So he built in his front yard a forest garden. You don't have to pull weeds. You don't have to spray for bugs. You don't have to do anything. You can beautify it and all if you want. Anyway, that's spawned a whole movement across the world called forest gardening or permaculture, meaning mm-hmm. permanent agriculture. It's very easy for me to imagine that that's what the Garden of Eden was. God, in his great wisdom, knew how all of these plants and insects and animals would ideally interplay with each other, their different systems working together, and created a garden just like that. We, in our finite wisdom, think we know better, and so we created the type of agriculture we have today, which you have to keep spraying for bugs constantly. When you spray for aphids, you also kill the bugs that eat aphids. And aphids reproduce faster than the bugs that you killed that eat aphids, so you're constantly going to have to be spraying for aphids, constantly. It never ends.
Same problem when you fertilize.
Yeah.
Artificially fertilize, yep.
So because we think we know better than God, we've created an agricultural system which, although it is highly productive, I'm not convinced it's sustainable long-term. And also the quality of the food is greatly in question, I think, by a lot of people.
Absolutely.
So there's another... traditions of our fathers that we've adopted, not realizing that, you know, they're based in pride and therefore not wouldn't be welcome or not welcome is not the word I want wouldn't have a place in a Zion society.
Absolutely. And this brings up a couple of different thoughts. One is that really that's probably one of the first and greatest traditions of pride that we have as the human race have adopted, which is that we know more than nature.
Mm-hmm.
That we have more to add to nature than nature has to teach us.
Right.
Which is silly and incredibly egotistical. And then I don't know if you know this or anyone else listening, but I heard this somewhere, and so I decided I was going to check this out because I thought, you've got to be kidding me. This can't be true. So it turns out this guy was saying how if you took every single living person on this planet and brought us all together in one space and gave every single living person roughly half an acre each, which if you're vegan is entirely sustainable, you can feed yourself quite easily on that. The entire world population would only take up roughly the square mileage of Brazil. And
wow.
We would have the whole entire rest of the world.
As a nature preserve.
Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing.
So when people say that we have problems because we have all these people who live in areas that it's just too hard to be sustainable and all this stuff and that we just can't all fit in this and that, whatever, bunk. Complete bunk. And the idea of, well, we can't be having too many more kids. If you have too many kids, we're growing at just too high of a rate and we're just going to completely overwhelm the planet in no time. Bunk. Complete bunk. It's crap. It's all lies that just trying to feed our fears.
And fear, I think, is like the opposite of, I don't know, what, faith or something?
Yeah. So when the scriptures and when our prophets are saying that God created our world to be more than enough, going back to that El Shaddai from last week, to be more than enough for us, it is. It always has been, and it will continue to be.
I think I love this quote by Brigham Young. Let me share it. It's from 1874, speech he gave. Have we separated ourselves from the nations? Yes, meaning, you know, move to Utah. Mm-hmm. And what else have we done? Ask ourselves the question, have we not brought Babylon with us? Are we not promoting Babylon here in our midst? Are we not fostering the spirit of Babylon that is now abroad on the face of the whole earth? I ask myself this question and I answer yes. Yes, to some extent there is not a Latter-day Saint, but what feels that we have too much of Babylon in our midst. The spirit of Babylon is too prevalent here. What is it? Confusion? Discord, strife, animosity, vexation, pride, arrogance, self-will, and the spirit of the world. Are these things in our midst of those called Latter-day Saints? Yes, and we feel this. And yet, we keep doing it. I attend the church, you know, the fourth Sunday thing where the bishop gets up and talks about pornography and other stuff, and I think, okay, how long... how bad does it have to get before we reject Babylon? How bad? Are we going to wait until our neighbors are murdering each other to say, okay, well, maybe we should back off this Babylon thing?
Well, but you have to recognize that it's Babylon. That's the thing.
Yeah,
all of these traditions,
true.
Once you've accepted them, to you are right. And they're not Babylon. They're just true. And it's not until we put up the white flag and say, okay, God, I have no idea what I'm doing. Please show me. And if there is an area where I am wrong, where my understanding is wrong, then please show me. I am willing and open to give it all up.
Yeah.
And that's humility.
Back where he belongs.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know there's actually a tribe in Africa where they know about pornography, they've seen it, but it holds no interest for them. They think we are nuts.
Well, aren't we?
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, they talk about pornography. I hear it all the time about how it's just so addictive and it's so pervasive and it's just a guaranteed thing that our children are just going to see it. It's going to be a problem and we just need to do our best to inoculate against it. But instead of teaching, and this is where I really struggle, there's some wonderful things out there really trying to teach our children against pornography. Where I struggle is that the best way to inoculate our children against pornography is to do exactly what this African tribe does. Where
go around without tops?
Well, yeah, basically a lot of them are. But it's not just, it's not that. It's the fact that to them, the human body is simply part of a whole. And the sexuality is just one small part of that whole. And it's more like a switch that can get turned on and off. You don't have to have it on. You don't have to have it off. And during puberty, it kind of wigs out, but that's just normal. And it's looked at as normal. And so instead of this shame-based, if you have a thought about this, that is bad and evil and wicked and you need to repent, it's, well, that's normal. Of course you're going to have that kind of a reaction, especially when you're 14 and 15 and 18 and, you know, whatever. Yeah. That's fine, but then move on. Because that person that you just had that thought about is a whole person.
Hmm.
There's
more to them than that. Yeah, you bring up a good point, the shame issue. I've recently been introduced to Brené Brown's talks about shame in her books. And I have some work I do that I can listen to audiobooks. And while I do it, and listening to her book called Daring Greatly, she introduces the idea of shame and how we shame each other. It's really interesting. Once I Joyce Berry's listening to the call, I think he'll particularly appreciate this. It occurred to me after listening to her book all the way through and reading some of the next one with my wife that she's basically talking about cultural false beliefs that we have as a nation and in regards to states of being that we poo-poo as a country, as individuals, in families, and also as a nation. And I'm really not doing it justice, but I was really impressed with the fact that she's coming to it from a completely different direction. She's not LDS, as far as I know. She gave a couple of TED Talks that were really remarkable and very well received. She talks about, you know, the shaming that we do from childhood on. In fact, I think that's how the false beliefs carry from one generation to the next, is through shaming of children.
Absolutely.
For this and that and the other thing.
And we do it to ourselves. Well, we don't actually do it to ourselves. Satan does a really good job of doing it to us without other people's input as
well.
Yeah,
that was one of the points she made, is that, you know, our parents do this to us, and then we grow up and we figure out we can do it to ourselves. Thank you very much.
Yeah. And but we do it even at young ages.
Mm-hmm.
I actually just had a conversation with my son not too long ago where I was asking him about some stuff he'd seen on YouTube, and I was asking if he'd seen anything inappropriate, and he said, and it wasn't the first time, it's not the first time that he or my daughter Lily or, you know, any of them have done it, where they said, I don't want to say. And it was because they were listening to those voices that were shaming them, that were saying, if you say it out loud, you're going to be in trouble, or it's going to hurt, or something's going to go really wrong, or it's going to prove that you're bad, or whatever it is that's going on in there. And for each one of them, whatever that script is a little different because it's always catered to what's going to most get you.
Yeah.
And so he didn't want to say it. And I had to teach him, and as I've taught my kids many times, because it's one of those that it takes several times to really get, that anytime you have those feelings, that is someone else, or that is a spirit or whatever you want to call it, that is trying to keep you from doing what's right, and it's trying to gain this power over you. But that once you speak it, that power goes away.
Mm.
And the moment that he was actually able to say what he was so worried about saying, I was like, oh, see, that was no big deal. Don't you feel better? And he immediately went from, literally, he was quivering and tears streaming down his face going, I don't know why, but I just can't say it. I just don't want to. I just really, really don't want to. Please, can I not say it? And finally, he just spelled it because that was all he could do. And that was it. All of a sudden, all of that weight lifted off. And that's what we're creating every time we allow these things to create this shame and guilt. We're allowing these things to have a power that they have no business having over us. And we have to eliminate that shame. We have to eliminate that guilt. And we have to teach our kids that feeling of shame or guilt only has power over you because you care. And the fact that you care matters more than that feeling of shame.
Cool. All right, so let's see. We've discussed Babylon's principles in education, agriculture. Essentially, we touched on it here in parenting.
Mm-hmm.
What's left? government. That one's easy. Huh?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, both sides are really just different sides of the same coin. I don't really see them as much different from each other anymore.
Well, I completely separate politics out from this. Government, the idea that we, the ruling class, know better than you do how you should run your life, that's obviously pride. And I think the type of government that God inspired, who was it, Jethro, to tell Moses about, a bottom-up republic, would work much better for everybody. And I actually, you know, the idea where you have the captains of 10 and 100 and such, I actually laid out what I call the Disaster Prep Club. The website's still up and going, disasterprepclubs.org, I think. And it has a video explaining how, you know, you could set up this disaster prep club in your area. Well, it's literally just the same bottom-up republic with the excuse of disaster prep as the, you know, focal point. But, you know, when you have 10 neighbors who come together and say, okay, what issues do we have that we are concerned about that we want to deal with, and you solve them on that level, you know, then that's as decentralized a government as possible. But the idea that we need big government to save us from all our problems is about as Babylon as it gets, in my opinion.
Oh, absolutely. And yet we have a society that every time something goes wrong, everyone suddenly starts clamoring, why didn't the government save us from this? The government needs to step in.
Because we're helpless and we can't do anything for ourselves.
Well, and we want to be, or obviously I don't want to be, but a lot of people, you know, that the society in general seems to really want that. It's a constant, well, I don't want to have to think about it. Just put someone else in charge of that. And then instead of having to actually think for myself and make real decisions.
And take responsibility.
I can just, yeah, exactly. Take responsibility for myself. I can just sort of go along pretending that I have all this freedom and that I can do whatever I want, when really I'm just slowly adding more and more chains and weight to my shackles.
Yeah.
But the country, when it was first founded, really was founded to be a republic, a modified republic, but a republic.
Yeah.
Much more so than a democracy. And Lincoln had quite the hand in changing that. We hear him constantly revered in history, and I think that he is a great example in his own way. I think every person actually is, but he just smashed through the Constitution. He was like, oh, this part's not working for me. I'm just going to make this executive order and do this thing instead. And oh, this isn't working the way I want it to. And I mean, it really was a lot about control and forcing people to do what he wanted versus what the people really wanted. The government, when the Constitution was created and all of that, it was created with the idea that it was a completely voluntary thing for any and all states to be a part of this union.
Hmm.
And the southern states were supposed to be able to peacefully withdraw anytime they wanted. And if they wanted to come back, it would be work to come back, but that they could. And Abraham Lincoln said, no, I'm not going to let you.
Hmm.
And, yeah, anyway, we could go on that. But yeah, we have gone very far, very, very far from what our founding fathers really started and created for us, because they had done immense research into government and how that is built, and into the natural laws and universal laws and God's laws, and mm-hmm. and how to have a government that was as uncentralized as possible.
But that requires us to show up to the neighborhood meeting, and it requires
exactly.
us to get involved and to participate, and we don't want to. We're, you know,
absolutely. And it requires us to educate ourselves
right.
on those things.
Right.
And again, we don't want to. And the public school system certainly is not trying to. They have no vested interest in making sure we're educated as to the founding principles of our country.
Okay, so before we get too depressed, the good news is we can study these alternative approaches to all of these areas of society. I think, like you mentioned at the very beginning, Andrea, there's lots of examples of people around the world who are implementing Zion-like principles. You know, the Basques in northern Spain is a perfect example. They have a whole
mm-hmm.
sub-economy based on cooperative free enterprise, and they're just their annual growth rate is 7%, and when all of Europe is having a recession, they're doing just fine. They have their own healthcare
Absolutely.
System, they have their own retirement program, they have their own banks, they have their own everything. It's a self-contained,
yep.
pretty much a self-contained, self-reliant society, which is what Brigham and John Taylor and Wilford Woodruff were hoping to set up here in Utah. But
absolutely.
It got derailed.
The Amish have a lot to teach us, and even Babylon itself has a lot to teach us. It's just learning to wade through and sift through
the pride
those,
element.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cool. Well, this has been very interesting. Thank you, Andrea, so much for spurring
well,
this
thank
all
you.
On. This is all your fault. You realize that, right?
I am very okay with taking responsibility and credit for that. Just don't puff up my ego too much.
Oh, okay, all right. Well, I have no idea what we're going to talk about next week, but I'm sure it'll be interesting. Maybe we can review some of the some of the very interesting aspects of Zion that the early prophets in Utah talked about. As I mentioned earlier, I gathered all of these quotes and grouped them into about 12 different groups of subject matter, and was very, very surprised to discover that to them, Zion is very different than what we today in the church think of Zion. Maybe we can talk about that next time.
Yeah, that I think you should take one of those. You should probably take one of those
topics
each time we talk, don't you think? And if each one needs maybe more time, then we could subdivide it. But
sure.
I think you should just go ahead and follow your outline.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right, great. Well, thanks so much, everybody. This has been wonderful. We'll have to do it again.
Thank you.
Yay.
Yeah, and we'll have this recording available. I'll probably end up creating a page on buildingzion.org to house all these recordings and people new to the site and to the idea can benefit from those. So thank you, everyone. Have a nice evening.
Good night.
Goodbye, and thank you.